I have to say, I listened to Steve's sermon from a month ago on chapters 1 and 2, and I think he got the easy job. I got four chapters here to try and chunk through, and those of you who know me well know I can be long-winded, but I am aiming to get us out of here at 7:30 on the dot, so I've got 45 minutes, and do we have a closing song?
Yes.
We do. What is it?
No?
Christ Triumphant, that's a good theme. So part of the aim of this evening is to help us think through philosophy, because that's what the book of Ecclesiastes really is. It's a book of philosophy. It's a book of man trying to discover truth apart from God, if you will. That's what the phrase under the sun means. It's this idea of what can I discover inside the universe from my own personal experience and what I observe. And we're going to try and put some of those thoughts together. We'll reference chapters 3 through 6 as we go through, because the writer, I have to disagree with you, Steve, I think is Solomon, but we don't argue. He was king in Jerusalem. Whoever it was, knew a lot of stuff. He's going to observe some things from human experience in chapters 3 through 6, which are mainly philosophical thoughts. So we're going to think about philosophy in general. The biggest book I have in my library is a book which I think is entitled A Book of Christian Philosophy, and it's this thick. And it's a book of Christian, it's very good, and you get lost about after 100 pages. And I think I'm reasonably intelligent, and I got lost. So what we're going to do this evening is sort of delve into chapters 3 through 6. I'm going to reference Steve's opening remarks, just summarily, because they're very critical to what happens as we go on through as well. So can we have the first slide? So the title is The Journey Continued into the Meaning and Purpose of Life from Human Experience. And Steve gave us various definitions the other week, and that's the one I'm going to put in this week, is the idea of under the sun is what you and I can know without divine revelation. It's a very careful distinction, if you will. It's what you and I can know by observation without human experience, without divine revelation. So what can the average person discover being in the world? Here's where he's going to go. Next slide. Hebel is the Hebrew word, I think, and the idea is breath or meaningless. It's got a philosophical idea. I like the image of a soap bubble. You know those little things, you have a ring and you blow through them and it floats away? Aren't they fantastic? Do you have a little bottle of that stuff you put in? Who's got grandchildren? Yeah, wonderful things, grandchildren. The writer's going to tell you to enjoy your grandchildren in a little while. But you put one of those, give them one of those. They're fascinated for hours with those things. Blowing bubbles and the wind carries them away and they're wonderful. They're iridescent. Their colours, it reflects everything. And there's a picture of one right there. You see it? You see the little finger? You see what's happening? These photographs are taken about a 500th second. So this is five photographs. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So very, very quickly. Next slide. Next slide. Next slide. Boom. Boom. And the writer is saying that everything he encounters and experiences in this world is meaningless, vanity of vanities, cigar smoke. It's a soap bubble. It's there, it looks beautiful, but you just touch it, or it touches something, and finished. Finished. Gone. And that's what the writer is going to take us through in his journey of discovery. And you say, well, couldn't he have just said that in one sentence? Yeah, he could have done. But he's recounting his life experience. If you've ever talked to people who don't know Jesus, especially if you do it in France, Claire, I'm so glad you're here. I've got something special for you this evening. Especially if you do it in France, every French student before the age of 18 takes a course in philosophy. And they have to learn about Socrates and Plato and the German chaps and then the French chaps, Jean-Paul Sartre. Oh, he's my hero, Jean-Paul Sartre. He's the father of what we call existentialism. Existentialism is a philosophical thought that says life is meaningless. I think we got the next slide. What's the next slide? No, not yet. We'll come back to that one. We'll get to Jean-Paul Sartre in a minute. We'll get to his two quotes. He's the father of existentialism, and existentialism says life is essentially meaningless. The writer, the biblical writer, agrees, or actually Jean-Paul Sartre should have read his Bible, and he would have agreed with the writer here. And therefore, because life is meaningless, it is pointless, it is random, you are just an accident on this earth, you have to create your own meaning. That's the ground basis of existentialism. We don't even know it, but that's our culture today, isn't it? That's what we live in the Western world. And in the UK, we haven't even had a philosophical discussion, and students in schools don't even understand that's the basis of which our political system now works. But that's what's happening in this country. This country is in a place where people say life is essentially pointless. Find your own, do your own thing, find your own meaning, and you give life its value. That's existentialism right there. That's Jean-Paul Sartre's great philosophy, which he endowed to the Western world. And that's what the writer to Ecclesiastes is also saying. He's going to add a caveat. He does it numerous places through here as well, because he was a Jewish chap. He did seem to know about something of the scriptures as well, yeah? So when we lived in France, my son did my daughter did higher education in French, and in French system you encounter these ideas on a regular basis. My son did an undergraduate degree and a master's degree in jazz and at the University of Toulouse-Mirail, and he encountered a lot of friends who he wanted to talk to about Jesus. And at the time I was working through Ecclesiastes with the youth group, and he wrote this song. So I'm going to play it for you. Now, it's in French, so I've put the words translated up there for you. Read the words, and we're going to take this approach to the rest of this evening as well. So, Claire, just for you this evening, let's go for it. The words will appear, and I won't read them out loud, so you can read them on the screen. It's translations in English.
De nombreux hommes ont parcouru cette terre, dit le sage à son élève. Il bafouille, il bégaye, quel ridicule révolutionnaire. Il vit dans un rêve.
Living a dream.
Avant même la question, ils veulent une réponse. Ils cherchent un sens, qu'elle recherche un temps. Et moi aussi,
j'ai dit
à mon cœur, travaillons afin de gagner le bonheur. Mais j'ai découvert que une grande richesse, ce n'est qu'un tourment qu'on peut suivre le vent. Un gros dérapage, ainsi parla le sage. Au début, j'ai entrepris de grandes études. Ce n'était qu'un par la suite, j'ai absorbé tellement de connaissances que j'en ai usé. Mais elle n'empêchait ni de tomber en décrépitude, ni de trouver une vie de plénitude. Ah, j'ai vu la futilité de la sagesse, oh vanité, quelle tristesse. Et j'ai découvert une grande sagesse, ce n'est qu'un tourment qu'on peut suivre le vent. Un gros dérapage, ainsi parla le sein. Après le plaisir est devenu mon dieu, une conversion hédoniste. Le désir me motive, ça peut qu'être avantageux, c'est sûrement la bonne piste. Donc je me permettrai tout ce que je veux, car le plaisir me rendra heureux. De grands amours, de grandes fêtes pour être satisfait, mais je n'avais toujours pas de paix. Et j'ai découvert qu'un grand désir, ce n'est qu'un tourment que pour suivre le vent. Un gros dérapage, ainsi parla le sage. Enfin, je me suis épuisé et j'ai dit toutes tes vanités. Celui qui cherche un sens, alors c'est un insensé. Mais soudain, je me suis rappelé le créateur de ma jeunesse, qui m'a accordé tant de sagesse et m'a comblé de toute richesse. Ce n'était que lorsque je me suis éloigné de lui que j'ai découvert que la vie entière, ce n'est qu'un tourment qu'on poursuivre le vent. Un gros dérapage, ainsi parla le sage.
So you can see my son's take on this, I think he got it from me, I'm sure he did, was that Solomon's writing this account of his look in life and what life can encounter and what you can discover from it, and it's not until he remembers that he walked away from his young man's faith that he rediscovers the reason for life, which he does towards the end of the book. That puts Solomon in a place where he knows what truth is from the Old Testament law, the first five books of the Bible. You remember every king had to write out his own copy of the scriptures. Yeah? Every king was commanded, they had to write out his own copy of the scriptures. Solomon had to write out his copy, David his, and the line goes on. And if you didn't do it, you were a bad king. Incidentally, it's a really good way of putting the scriptures into your mind is to write them out. It's old-fashioned, but it puts them in your head. So he writes out his own copy, and then he walks away from it. How many wives and whatever else did he have? 700, was it? Was that correct? He imbibes all this knowledge from the known world at that time, and he puts it all in, and he decides he wants to explore the meaning of life. And it's not until he remembers that he walked away from God that he remembers what it's like to have meaning and purpose in life as well. But in the meantime, in his grand discovery, he's sort of going through things and saying, what is the point of them? What can I learn from them as well? Here's Jean-Paul Sartre, two quotes. Man is a useless passion. Does that make you feel good? Next one. Every existing thing is born without reason, prolongs itself out of weakness, and dies by chance. There's existentialism. There's the meaninglessness of life, according to Jean-Paul Sartre, according to existentialism. And in a sense, the writer, the wise man, the sage of Ecclesiastes, the preacher, is saying the same thing, that if you discount the revelation of God, the scriptures, life is pretty pointless. Life is a soap bubble. It looks pretty, but as soon as it touches everything, pop, it's gone. You get 70 years, 80 years, 90 years, and pop, it's gone, is what he says. Next slide. I want to try and summarize. Steve, I hope I've been fair. I did listen and take notes from the wonders of the internet. Summary of what Steve said. The question, what does man gain from his life? Chapter 1, verse 3. Here is what he said. The created order is constantly changing, but repeats itself. You remember the wind keeps going round. The sun keeps going up and down, round and round. Created order is constantly changing, but repeats itself. Knowledge of wisdom is futility. This was a very wise man. He says, at the end of the day, doesn't count for nothing. Pleasure in the end is meaningless. However, he does say wisdom is better than stupidity, folly. Yeah? And he says, the joy that life brings is from God. He's going to come back to that theme of joy even during these next chapters, three times. And one of the closing questions I'm going to ask you as we think about it is this idea of what joy is and how we express it in our own lives as well. Next slide, please. I do want to take a sort of minor detour because I need to convince you that the search for knowledge or truth is actually important. Now, again, I did my O-levels. I did 10 O-levels when it counted. And I did A-levels in chemistry, maths, and physics. And I chose not to go to university. But if I'd gone to university like my brother, who did electrical engineering, and my father before him, who did electrical engineering, I would have been studying for 3 years electrical engineering. And in the UK, we don't get what we call a general education, do we? We don't do philosophy. We don't do psychology if you're over the age of 40. Now, it could be that young people today in university do that kind of studies. Do we have any young people here? Put your hand up if you're under the age of 30 and have a college degree. So nobody knows here whether you studied psychology or philosophy or anything in university. But I'm telling you, the rest of the world does. In France, Claire, am I right? It's like the dreaded subject as well, isn't it, at age 18? The rest of the world studies philosophy. In America, they do a general education for 4 years. And they can talk to you quite eloquently about philosophy and psychology and all those kind of things. I did my undergraduate education in America, so I have some knowledge of that. One of the things you have to prepare American students for as they go to university is because they're going to sit in a class of 300 people and they're going to have a professor who's got a PhD in sociology or in psychology or in philosophy, and he's going to just say to them all, look at them all, and he's going to say, everything you believed is not true, especially if you come out of a church background. That's his starting point. He's going to say that. And one of the things you have to do is prepare students to encounter that kind of mindset. So these things are taken out of a book. I forget what it's called, but three chapters. I summarize the points about the search for truth. And they start with this idea, three general myths about truth. Because that's what the writer is just wanting to discover, truth. He says, the first thing they'll try and tell you is that thinking about truth is arrogant and intolerant. The second one is the important thing in life isn't having the truth, but searching for it. And the third thing is that faith hinders the search for truth because it gets in the way of reasoning. I want to tell you, that's what we believe in this country by and large as well. That's what a pluralistic society encourages people to operate out of. You say you think you know the truth, you think you know Jesus, you're bigoted, your mindset is closed, you're not interested in anything else. How can you possibly know truth? You are arrogant and intolerant. Isn't that where our culture is at today? John's nodding his head. I know I'm on track. Steve's nodding his head. I know I'm on track. You've been with college students as well, right, Steve? Do they do philosophy in universities today? Not really.
You can study it.
You can study it, but you don't have to do it. Whereas in the continent, everybody has to do it. Yeah. The second myth about searching for truth is that important thing in life isn't having the truth, but searching for it. As long as you're on the journey, it's okay. You don't have to find it. You just have to want to try and find it. That's what's important. That's how we can accept each other, because you're on the search towards the Hindu God, and I'm on search towards the Muhammad God, and he's on search to the atheist God, and we're all happy because we're all searching for it. The whole point in searching for truth, guess what? Is to find the stuff. Right? Saying the thing is important in life isn't having it, but searching for it is like saying that the important thing in sickness isn't getting well, but seeing doctors. Third thing, faith hinders the search for truth because it gets in the way of reasoning. I know you've heard that before. Right? oh, you're people of faith. Oh, it's like, oh, you're so substandard. Yeah? Oh, you're people of faith. But I want to tell you that reasoning depends on faith. Everybody believes something. Everybody has faith in something. The atheist is saying, I've searched the whole world, and I haven't found God, and I'm trusting myself, I'm believing in myself. That's what the atheist is believing in himself. Reasoning depends on faith. Falsely placed faith will keep you from the truth, but rightly placed faith will help you find it. So in this search for truth which the writer is on, as we're thinking about, this stuff is really quite relevant to where people are at. If you're involved in apologetics or philosophical reasoning with anybody in a discussion over a pint of beer with people who say, you're so arrogant, thinking you know the truth. Well, don't you want to know the truth? I'm going to suggest to you that some of these ideas are actually relevant to our evangelism, even in our culture. They were when we lived in France. Skeptical myths. There isn't any truth. Doesn't make sense that there isn't any truth, because then it wouldn't even mean true to say that there isn't any. It's the logical argument, right? There isn't any truth. Well, how do you know that? Because I just said it. Well, is that a truth? No, we can't. Oh, you just contradicted yourself as soon as somebody says that. That's a skeptical myth. Maybe truth exists, but we can't find it. It doesn't make sense to claim truth can't be found, because to claim anything at all is to imply that the claim is true. Well, you can't possibly find truth. I've just uttered a statement which I believe is true. Well, how can you possibly have found that then, if you just told me I can't? Again, it's that illogical argument which people use. 6. Maybe we can find out some truth, but not the biggest and most important things. And here we do a little bit of Jesus in there, if you will. The biggest and most important truths aren't harder to find than the little ones. In fact, they're easier because God has provided help. Have you read the Bible recently? Yeah? We know that as Christians. The big answers are already there for us. They're written down in black and white, communicated through the ages. This book is our friend. It's got truth in it. And then it tells us about the one who is the truth on top of it, if you will. There's a difference between word with a little W and word with a capital W and truth with a little T and truth with a big T. Jesus is the word and the truth, and the Bible is the word and the truth. You understand the difference? Huh? Relativist myths. Here's the Jean-Paul Sartre philosophy starting to kick in. Truth is whatever you sincerely believe. You've heard a variation on that one, I know. As long as you believe it's true and you're sincere with it, it must count. Right? We've all got neighbors who believe that. I had somebody say to me, in regard to a funeral just recently, it might have been about Jim's. No, it was about my sister, who's also dying of cancer. And some friends came in to see her when she was in the hospice while we were there. And they said, well, she's all right. She's got you. You're a brother and you're a minister, so you can get her to go. And he really believed that. He really believed that she was good for the next life because she had a brother who'd do a funeral for her. It's a very commonly held belief. Truth isn't whatever you sincerely believe. Only a magician could make something true just by thinking about it. It's just because you think something is true, it doesn't make it true. Truth is whatever people accept or whatever you can get them to swallow. Popular agreement doesn't make a statement true. People have been swallowing nonsense the world began. Now that's true, isn't it? Yeah. Are we in the middle of a political campaign or not? Yeah. Truth is whatever works. Again, relativism. You're making up your own truth. There's no meaning in life, so you've got to kind of make it work for yourself. That's the attitude which is around us all today in this country. And people don't even know why they believe it. They've been told that somehow. It's in the media. It's what you try and discover because of life. And people are on this journey in life, some of them, to actually think about it, like the writer to Ecclesiastes was, in his own way. Next slide, please. Now, let's just look at the text a little bit, having done all the background work. I'm not going to do the details, because it's a lot of time, a lot of text. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 1 through 15. Remember this passage, there's a time for everything and a season for every activity under the sun, under heaven. I think the Birds wrote a song about it. Do you remember that? Those of you who are old enough, right? There is a season, turn, turn, turn. I almost had Sam play it, but we did one piece of music already and, you know, you didn't come here for a concert, did you? Or maybe it's better, maybe you did. Turn, turn, time for everything. Time to be born, time to tear, time to mend, time to be silent. And he asks again, verse 9, what does the worker gain from his toil? I've seen the burden God has laid on men. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men. It's a famous phrase people use. There's a problem with the translation. I don't think it makes any difference to our understanding. The word eternity could actually be the word world in our language. So he's put the universe in people's hearts, or eternity. Sometimes we use this verse to mean that, hey, God's left something inside every human which makes them long for something bigger. Whether that's eternity or this idea of what is the purpose of the world, I don't think at the end of the day makes any difference, because it's something inside of us that says we're not just animals. That's the important part in that. Whatever this thing is inside of us, it means we're above the animals. We think about things, whether it's eternity or the nature of the universe. Put eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. I know there is nothing better for men than to be happy and to do good while they live. So the writer seems to be saying, I'm going to quote C.S. Lewis, if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. And the writer seems to be starting to hint here that our experience in life means there's got to be something more than just here and what's now. And he's going to do it through this idea of the word world, that there, not only is time continuous, remember it goes round and round and round and round, the sun, the wind, what was is again, from chapter 1, but there's also this idea of punctilia action, punctilia time. We experience things in the here and now. So time is both continuous and punctilia. The punctilia time, which is what he's talking about in chapter 3, these time for doing different things, is our experience within time. Does that make sense? That's very philosophical, isn't it? That's what the Greek philosophers struggled with 400 years before Christ. What is the nature of time? My wife and I are in a happy place where we are grandparents. And we get these little videos from our son and his wife of our grandson, Thijs, or Matthijs, because he's got a Dutch mother, which is Dutch for Matthew, and his second name is mine, Andrew, and his third name is Ebenezer. Pronounce it for me, French style, Ebenezer, because God is their help, so he's got an English name, a Dutch name, and a French name. We're watching these little videos of him, and my wife pulls up a video when our son was one. I tell you what, I can never get that back again. I can watch the video, but I'll never get that experience of playing with my 9-month-old son when he was that old. It'll never happen again. There's a time for playing with 9-month-year-old sons, and then there's a time for playing with 4-year-old grandchildren, isn't there, Gordon? Yeah? And that's what the writer is saying. There's something in the nature of the universe about time which means there's more to this life. Because it keeps going round, but there's moments which can never be re-experienced. Unlike the stuff which keeps going round and round. That's his argument. That's what he's saying. Conclusion then. Out of this idea about time, and it's both circular and continuous, and the idea that it's punctilia. Hey, enjoy. Look in chapter 3, verses 12 through 15. He says, I know that there is nothing better for the men to be happy and do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil. Steve told us that toil is not just work, work, work. It's the stuff you do on earth while you're living. It includes work, but it's all the other things as well. This is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure forever, that nothing can be added to it, nothing taken away from it. God does this so that men will revere him. So he says, hey, time, enjoy the stuff, enjoy those actions in it. And he makes reference to this idea of somebody outside of himself, God, for the first time now. He's going to introduce God into his discovery. He says in his discovery of life, there has to be something bigger because of the nature of time, because of my experience of stuff, and I'm going to call that thing God. He actually knows who the God is, the true God, the creator God, and he knows some of the characteristics of the God who really is as well. Didn't make mention much of those. Next slide, please. The elementary question, God. It is a question of belief, isn't it? However, just remember that everybody believes in something or someone. I can't reiterate that enough in our modern culture. We as Christians are often accused of being people of faith, as if others aren't. No, no. What happened when you became a Christian was you changed faiths. You changed what you used to believe to trusting Jesus. If you grew up in a Christian environment, maybe you're a C of E background, you know? Churches and Easter. You got sprinkled and you got married and you expect to die there, you know? You believed in God. And when you became a Christian, guess what happened? You started to believe in Jesus. You trusted in Jesus. Yeah, that's not all C of E, don't get me wrong. Yeah? What happens to a Muslim? He's trusting Muhammad and the Quran and trying to be a good guy or something. What happens when he stops trusting that and instead he starts to trust in who? Jesus. He used to trust, believe and trust are the same word, aren't they? Remember that? Yeah, believe and trust. It's not just head, it's heart and will as well. Used to believe in this stuff, now trust in Jesus. A person who's, a communist, what do they believe in? The teachings of Chairman Mao is who they believe in. And what do they do when they become a Christian? They say, you know, that stuff is good stuff for China, and it has a way of, but actually, it's not going to do anything for me. I'm going to start believing Jesus and his teachings. I've become a Christian. You're changing belief systems. Some people are stupid enough to trust the politicians. And then they become Christians because they get fed up with this Western world we live in. And they say, I'm going to stop trusting that seven cradle to grave or whatever they're offering now is good. And I'm going to trust in Jesus for this life and for the next one. We all trust in something. So when he starts introducing God, we shouldn't be ashamed of doing that as well as if we're unique. No, we're unique because we trust in Jesus. We're not unique because we trust. And the writer is starting to introduce God into this passage here now. What does the scripture say? The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Psalm 14, verse 1, 15, 53, verse 1. And you remember the great attributes of God. Without faith, it is impossible. Hebrews 11, verse 6, because you must believe that he is and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. Chapter 11, verse 6 of Hebrews. The two great characteristics of the true God. He is a person. He's knowable, and he rewards you. So the writer, any person who you encounter on a journey to find the meaning of life, we know who the meaning of life is, don't we? We do, don't we? It's a relationship with Jesus, right? That's the meaning of life. That's what it's here for. That's why we live on this planet for 80 years. We might try and discover Jesus. But we know that. But anybody who's on a discovery of doing something, we can tell them, hey, you know what? I think God's going to reward you. I think you're going to find the truth if you keep on the discovery, on the journey, on the quest. One of the great things that happened in the 60s was there was a whole bunch of people who got turned off by traditional church. And I'll tell you some reasons why in a moment. And they started a journey of discovery. Do you remember those people? They were called hippies. They took LSD. They did all kinds of stupid, crazy stuff. They were trying to make sense of the world they lived in. And the church wasn't giving them the answer at that time. Not in this country, not in America. But they were, and you know what? A lot of those people found Jesus at some point. Didn't they? Because they kept on searching. Because God is true to himself. He says, I will reward those who earnestly seek me. So let's not get rid of this quest in a hurry and say, well, we're Christian. But this is how we learn to relate to those who don't know Jesus, especially in our Western world. I don't know anything about any other part of the world, so I'll just leave it there. Next slide. Chapter 3, verses 16 through 22. We continue through this text, and it's 7:20 already. Look at that. Saw something else under the sun. What's he going to say in this passage here? He's going to say humanity's application of justice is inconsistent. He says animals die, they have no concept of justice or quest, and yet we die as well. How come we're different? It's part of his quest to life. Animals die, we die. They don't do a quest, they don't do a journey, they're not looking for meaning. Are we no different than the animals? That, if I could summarize his thought, I think that's what he's trying to say to us. Conclusion is still the same. Beauty, specific moments of time within the circle of life and justice still only lead to one conclusion. Man should rejoice in his work, verse 22. Remember that word work is toil. He should rejoice in his stuff of this life. Enjoy, rejoice, be thankful are these common themes he's going to pick up on all the way through. Next slide, please. Chapter 4, more about the human experience. Again, he's looking at his human experience, what every human can enjoy on this life in a sense, what it could lead them to. He says the nature of man's competitive, he examines oppression and comfort to start with. He says the nature of man's competitive spirit and therefore advancement is inconsistent. Sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. He looks at the inequality of human life under the sun in three different areas, the poor versus the rich. Still no satisfaction, even if you're rich. He looks at camaraderie, marriage, brotherhood, and there's that wonderful verse, a cord of three strings, how's it say? A cord of three strands is stronger. He's looking at the human condition, whether it's marriage or friendship, and he's saying it's good, it's interesting, it's something bigger. It's not like the animals, because they all die, but there's something more there. People write theses on this kind of stuff, don't they? I'm telling you, they do. If you study philosophy and things, they write the thesis of the human condition in regard to small communities and how they interact together in Lapland, in Newcastle. What are they're discovering, they're writing a paper on how humans have camaraderie together. The writer of Ecclesiastes summarizes it in three sentences. Advancement, verses 13 through 15. It's a good thing. But then someone else arises after you, sometimes even while you're still alive. Politicians come, politicians go. We even have famous books written, The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, The Rise and Disintegration of the British Empire. I made the last one up. British Empire, what's that? It was a thing which was around 100 years ago but is no more. Yeah. The only thing we've got left is the English language. And the Indians speak it better than we do in India. Rise and fall. Comes, goes. Somebody else comes on the world scene. You can have a job. You can be the king. You can be the prime minister. You can even be the pastor of a church. But guess what? The next guy's coming after you. Yeah. So that can't be the purpose of life. That can't be where you even find meaning, because it's not certain. It's not eternal. And meaning has to be eternal and certain if it's to be true. Conclusion, at the end of the day, verse 16, all is still vanity and a striving after wind, a soap bubble, he says. All these human experiences, nice as they are not where you're going to find meaning, purpose in life. It can't be done. People try to do it, but it's not there. Chapter 5, verses 1 through 9. Quest looks at how we treat God. He comes back to his theme of God again. He says, guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Go near to listen rather than offer the sacrifice of fools who do not know what they're doing. And I think what he's saying is, in these next verses, hey, even when people do God, whatever kind of God it is they're doing, even the true God, they're often inconsistent in it. So doing God, if you will, is not the right answer. We have the fortune or misfortune, I'm not sure which it is sometimes, to live in a post-Christian culture. We're not even post-Christian anymore. We're post-post, you know. And people don't want to do church. because they know they're hypocrites, they go there. They know they're irrelevant. They don't think about things. They're not enjoying life, etc., etc., etc. And he says, when people do God, they don't keep their vows. They don't keep their what they promised to him. He says, it can't. That's not where meaning is either, in unkept religion, if you will. And if it's true of Christianity in our modern culture, it's probably true of all the other religions out there as well. 5 verses 8 through 12, he returns to the theme of oppression again and justice. And he just concludes that a good king is best. Chapter 5, verse 9. A king who makes sure that people get what they need. I think he says the fields are full or something like that. There's harvest. You know, I'm glad I live in this country and not Russia at the moment. Because there's a king in Russia who really doesn't seem to care about the little guy, you know? So a king who takes care of people is a good thing, or a system that allows little people to be taken care of is a good thing, and oppression is a bad thing. He made another conclusion from his observation about life under the sun. But he is not meaning there. And remember, this is the king who's writing, so he's trying to provide for his people as well, they can live. Next slide, verses 10 through 20. Comes back to wealth. Money doesn't satisfy, he says. He uses three illustrations of why wealth or money or possessions cannot be the end of life, the end being the purpose or the meaning of life. And there's a great philosophical principle involved here as well. If you're going to say something is true, he says it must apply all the time, to all people, in all places. If it's a universal truth, it must apply to all people, at all times, in all places. Otherwise, it's not a universal truth. That's why existentialism is not true, because you're making up your own truth, right? And the writer, the wise one, the preacher here, is too smart to fall into that. Well, it's a 101 philosophy trap, you know? It's one of those relativist myths which we saw is actually pointless and easily argued against. And he says, because these things are true, they can't be the end of life, the meaning of life, because they're not universally true. The first thing he says is wealth lost causes bitterness. I knew a man back in the States, and he'd made $1 million four times over. Four times he'd made $1 million and lost it and gained it and lost it and gained it. And I knew him when he was well into his 70s. He made it doing a number of different businesses. The business I knew him when he was in was in antique business. And he bought and sold antiques all through his life, but in his old age, that's what he knew best, so we went back to that. He'd been involved in building trade and some other things as well. But, you know, I went with him to clear somebody's home one time who died. And down in the basement of their house, this person collected antique lamps. There was 100 antique lamps there. It was unbelievable. He said, we'll take this lot. Gave them a price, packed them all up, newspaper, put them in his van. And we got in the van, he said, it's the fourth time I've seen that lot, and I'm going to sell it all over again and make a profit again. Fourth time, selling the same set of lamps, 100 of them. Round the circle, and he says, I said, well, how do you deal with all that money you've lost over the years? Well, shouldn't you be a rich man? He says, yeah, it comes, it goes, you know. But money lost. I said, well, what happened to first? Because he'd been in the building trade. What happened when you did that? He said, I was angry. Angry. Money lost causes bitterness. I got a parking ticket the other day. I was so stinking mad. You ever been mad at getting a parking ticket? There's a store here in town, just around the corner, called... What's it called? It's a clothes store. Sorry? Matalan. And if you park in there, and you don't go into the store, they'll give you a ticket. Be warned. Money lost. 60 quid's worth. I was coming back. I was really mad. causes bitterness. Money loss causes bitterness. So money, wealth, possessions cannot be the answer, the meaning, the purpose of life. It doesn't go into the next world with you, does it? The pharaohs thought it could. Do you remember? They stuffed all this stuff in with their mummies and their wealth and Tutankhamun's tomb and all that stuff. And it was gone. They couldn't take it with them. Can't be universally true. Verse 17. Wealth doesn't mean happiness or joy. It doesn't automatically bring happiness and joy. So therefore, it can't be the universal truth that money, wealth, possessions is the answer, part of the meaning of life. Because verse 18 to 20, the gift of God is to choose to enjoy both work and its products in this life. Enjoy is repeated three times in this paragraph. Three times he says enjoy, have joy in it. In the toil and the things which you produce in this life. Next slide. The deceptive nature of work and the wealth produced. Keeps on going with wealth a little bit. It's deceptive, it seems to be saying. Wealth has to have power given to the owner to be enjoyed. If you just get money, it doesn't mean it, because you've got to have this other thing which only God can give. God's got to give the power to enjoy it. So the deceptiveness of wealth is it implies that you might enjoy life, but God's got to give the ability to enjoy it as well. Ooh, tricky stuff, money, isn't it? 6 verses 7 through 9. Appetites are never satisfied, he says. Have you noticed that? I had 3 square meals yesterday. I've had 2 today, and you know what? I'm anticipating my 3rd one when I get home this evening. You say, you eat late, don't you? I said, yeah, I'm French. We always eat late. Yeah? And I'll bet you what, you're probably anticipating your dinner tomorrow night as well, aren't you? Right? When you stop enjoying your food, you know what the next step is? Death. Your desire, though, is never satisfied. And it's not just the food desire. It's all kind of other desires. 6 verses 10 through 12, he talks about the naming of things. And I think it's this idea of the pride of life, the ability to be in control. He says it's not satisfied. There's always someone stronger. There's always more knowledge to have. It's more vanity. There's no knowledge of the future. He says, that can't be it as well. It reminds me of 1 John 2, verses 15 through 17. You know the passage? The lust of the eyes, the pride of life. It's those three things, he says. They never give it to you. They're not where life is at. And if you're a human and you don't have the scriptures and you're not a Christian, you can discover that for yourself. You can discover that the stuff of this world is not where the meaning of life is at. Isn't that good news? Yeah? It is, isn't it? Because that means people are on a journey to discover something. Here's Jean-Paul Sartre, at the very end of his life, written a few months before his death, at the bottom there, in a left-wing journal, from the National Review, 11th of June, 1982. You've got to find this one, because they don't teach it in school, Claire. Page 22, as quoted in Does God Believe in Atheists by John Blanchard. Here's a translation. I do not feel that I am the product of chance, a speck of dust in the universe, but someone who was expected, prepared, prefigured. In short, a being whom only a creator could put here, and the idea of a creating hand refers to God. Jean-Paul Sartre, at the end of his life, discovered there was God in the midst of his life. Now, did he become a Christian? I don't know. Did he say essentially what the writer to Ecclesiastes is saying to us? Yes, he did. Did he have the advantage of the writer of Ecclesiastes and having the 5 books of the Pentateuch memorized, written down by himself, taught on a daily basis, and a father who was called King David? No, he didn't. Where did he end up? I don't know. But you see where he got to in his quest of life? He starts, man is useless. A whim, no power, no control, and he ends up and says, no, there is something. In my experience of life, he says, there's something more. I was prepared, prefigured, In short, a creator could put me here. Only a creator could have put me here. Creating hand refers to God. Have I got one more slide there? Three sets of questions. Am I doing all right? Can you listen to this last three slides, I think? Yeah? For us to think about. Steve, I really appreciate your questions at the end of messages. I used to do notes, but, you know, questions after the sermon, you know, but this is really good. So three sets of questions. Questions to ponder about who we are as believers in Jesus. Do we give the impression that life is not to be enjoyed? That's the theme all the way through here, chapters 3 through 6. Enjoy, there's three verses, it's repeated three times, and two of the places he does enjoy life, enjoy it, enjoy your work. Do we give the impression that life is not to be enjoyed? I can't answer that question for you. My favourite comment to me when I was a pastor in the States was, Andrew, you don't seem like your typical pastor. It's like, yes! Because the second thing was, I could never relate to them. Somehow, they could relate to me. I seem to enjoy life or something, you know. In what ways do we represent God as a killjoy? It's a related question. So, you know, do people... Is it killjoy? You know? First time I met John, I thought, boy, he's an interesting chap. And I thought, he's even more interesting. He rides a motorcycle. God can ride motorcycles. God, the Holy Spirit's inside John, remember? God can ride a motorcycle. He seems to enjoy it. Oh, that's good news. I grew up in a church environment where God was sort of a bit of a killjoy, to be honest. You know? If you're enjoying it, it can't be from God. Last question. What are you enjoying in your momentary and fleeting life right now? Have I got the right feel to that one? Momentary and fleeting, that's the phrase here. But what are you enjoying right now? If you can't answer that question, you're representing God as a killjoy if you say you follow him. Yeah? You're representing God as something other than he really is, because he wants you to enjoy your life now. Is there enjoyment in all kinds of different things? You bet there is. But you better be enjoying them. How is work for you? Do you enjoy your work, the toil of your days, to produce the benefits which it gives to you? You've gotten this great privilege in this country, in the West, of doing something different if you don't like it. Go do something different. Our children said to us, Mom and Dad, what do you want us to do? And we said, we want you to do whatever the Lord wants you to do and whatever keeps you happy doing it. If you become a garbage truck driver and that's what you want to do, bin collector, that's the word, isn't it? If you become a bin collector and that's what you want to do, go be a bin collector. As long as you're happy doing it. Dad, I want to do music. Darn. I thought you were going to be a baseball hero or be a doctor in my old age and keep me. I'm going to study jazz. Great. He's going to be poor for the first 40 years of his life and probably more. My daughter comes home, you know, and daughter, she's doing this and then this and then this. And I said to her finally, Katie, you've got to pick something and finish it. She's got my habit of not finishing things. I can't keep paying for you forever. She said, I want to study photography. Oh, no, not photography. You'll never get rich doing photography. You can't even make a living at it. Andrew, what are you talking about? You trusted God all your life. Let your children have it. So she studied photography. And she's a good photographer. Are you enjoying it right now? How are you doing in giving thanks? It's related to joy, right? You ever ask that? It's actually a good question to ask a person who's not a Christian. Who do you give thanks to? In French, it really works well because you always remercie somebody. Je te remercie. I thank you. You know, but who do you? What are you thankful for right now? Are you doing it? Are you being thankful? And who are you thanking? And related again, what are you enjoying right now? What are you enjoying? I'm so excited. My son and his wife and their grandson are coming in 2.5 weeks. I was practicing cartwheels at somebody's house the other day with their 5-year-old. My wife looked at me afterwards and said, "Is your neck all right?" I said, "That's fine. I haven't done cartwheels yet. I'm excited about my, I'm going to enjoy my grandson." The old joke, you get to give him back after you wound him up at the end of the day. You know, Gordon's grinning at me. Last question. Evangelism. If our culture no longer has a Christian worldview, what are the good starting points for communicating the gospel message? Can I suggest to you that some of this stuff is a starting point when you're talking to people? Well, the Bible's the Word of God. What? Huh? Jesus died? What do you mean? That's the Easter Bunny, isn't it? What are you enjoying in life right now? Well, actually, it's kind of miserable. Do you think there might be enjoyment in life? It's possible. Yeah. Why do you think that enjoyment's possible when you're not enjoying it? Where did that thought come from? Now you're all into inner thought with somebody, aren't you? You're into a philosophical Ecclesiastes thought. How can philosophic thought in our preamble of the proclamation of Jesus be helpful? You've got to read Acts chapter 17. Because Paul does philosophy and ideas before he talks about Jesus. Before he talks about the Bible. All the other times in the book of Acts, he argues about Jesus and who's the Messiah and the Christ, and he defends the Old Testament, but not in this passage on Mars Hill. Evangelism question. Philosophical one. You want to talk to somebody about God? I don't believe in God. Okay, that's great. Tell me, if there was a God, what would you like him to be like? I've asked that question to lots of different people. And you know what they tend to say? I'd like him to be fair and loving. All the injustice in the world, I want him to do something about it. I want him to be fair. Pardon me, I want him to be fair. And I want him to care about people as well. And he clearly doesn't. Lots of people have something along those two lines. The justice and the love of God. Oh, you know, that's odd, that is. Because that's the book, the God of the Bible. He's fair and loving. Isn't it? Right? We are talking about the God of the Bible here. Yeah? That's odd. You want a God who's fair and loving, and the Bible presents one, and I know, I apologize for the church. We're not very good at doing that, are we? Presenting that God. But I want to tell you, that's what we say we believe, and if we're not very good at it, we believe in a God who's both fair and loving. He's fair because he takes care of the justice stuff, even though it looks like he doesn't now, and he's loving because you can know him, and he's worth loving, he's worth knowing. It's a little philosophical, but it does relate to people. They get it. Whereas they won't automatically get the Bible is the Word of God. If you don't believe it, you're going to hell. Or Jesus. You've got to trust Jesus because he lived and died and rose again. And he sent his Holy Spirit so you can do cool things for him. All those second ones are true statements. But there's no history underneath in order to do that as well. And the book of Ecclesiastes, I think, is the book for our Western world in terms of our evangelism message, which can really help us think through how to present Jesus to people. Now, there's some limits, remember. It's not about divine revelation. It's about what people can discover in this life. We still need God to present Jesus through us to those people. Don't get me wrong. But it helps people get to that place where you can do that. Let's pray.